all for making the trip back from the bistro, managing to forego the delicious pastry, the pecan, what was it, pecan?
I thought you'll say thanks for inviting me.
Yes, that's right, no. Yeah, well, thank you. I guess if the speaker should thank the audience. But anyway, so.
Thank the other organizer.
That's right, the other organizer, Rafael, for finishing in time. Right. Right. Okay, so good. So this is, hopefully it's going to be very brief. So the idea is, as you know, it's half of people here are more, well, I guess some are not expert in anything necessarily, but half are expert in causal sets, or half are expert in cosmology, or at least are more familiar with it. And he, the first day, the goal was to kind of get to know each other, basically, personally and, of course, scientifically. So the Hubble Trouble is kind of the nickname for this recent excitement about an anomaly or inconsistency in cosmological observations. I think more, I guess, in more professional circles, it's called Hubble Tension. Less professionally, it's called Hubble Crisis. So there are different names for it, but they all refer to the fact that there is an ever-growing conflict between different observations. So here, I'm just going to briefly summarize this. And here, I'm assuming that you don't have any background in cosmology. So some of this will be repetitive, but hopefully it's still funny. So this is, again, the... if you don't care about the universe at all, this is a census, dark energy, dark matter, intergalactic plasma. So we know and live within this, which is only between 0.2 to 0.6% of the energy density of the universe. And everything else, which is more than 99%, is dark, is either unknown or unexplored by us. So that's a short census of the universe.
What was the last one?
The last one are supermassive black holes. Yeah, so supermassive black holes and the stellar black holes are 0.0. So the point is that these are all dark, basically, right? So we haven't explored them. Even intergalactic plasma. Now, I guess there's...
Oh, God.
Yeah, there might be some evidence that, I guess, there's indirect evidence for it, but we don't... we don't see it directly. So... and again, so these are, I guess I just grabbed this slide from a colloquium, so everybody knows about this. So Einstein, he's, actually not everybody knows about this, because I do give this in qualifying exams to some graduate students. I don't know what this is about. So probably for graduate student audience, some of you should know this. Einstein initially introduced cosmological constant because the solutions to Einstein equations for a homogeneous universe, without the cosmological constant, there was no static solution. So Einstein introduced this constant called the cosmological constant that allowed a static solution to a homogeneous universe. However, Hubble discovered in 1929 that the universe is not a static on larger scales, in fact, expanding. And this is the first version of Hubble diagram. So then the cosmological constant was abandoned. And instead, the Hubble law was invented or was born. And here, to put everybody on the same page, when we talk about the Hubble constant, it's the proportionality constant in the Hubble law. So what was measured by Hubble was that the recessional velocity of galaxies, which we observe from their spectra, is linearly proportional to their distance from us. The velocity was measured from the spectra of galaxies, and the distance was measured from Cepheid variables. We're going to come back to Cepheid variables because it turns out we are still arguing about Cepheid variables in more than 100 years, well, I guess 90 years on. But then the main culprit here, the main character is this Hubble constant, and astronomers very, as Rafael mentioned, they want to confuse everyone. So this has units of 1 over time, but we use units of kilometer per second per megaparsec, which is one of the more convoluted units of time, basically, you would hear.
two units of space in the same constant.
That's right. It's kilometer per second per megaparsec. So technically, you would use hertz for Hubble if you want to follow SI units, but nobody uses hertz for Hubble. So I guess 10 to the minus 10 to the minus 14 hertz? No. What is it in hertz? 10 to the minus 17 hertz. It will be something of that order.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, but nevertheless, so the reason that people use it is that in these units you have kilometer per second, in this axis you have megaparsecs, this is 10 to the 6, 2 times 10 to the 6. So basically, literally, they divided this axis by this axis and came up with kilometer per second per megaparsec. So that's historically how this happened. Now, of course, this figure has evolved. I was showing you this little bit down here, and this is kind of a more modern, I guess, at this. Well, it's 12 years old now, but more modern version of the Hubble diagram. So we've gone to farther distances and farther velocities. And I guess actually the axes have flipped as well. I guess now people plot it a different way. And the big news at the turn of the century was that if you try to fit a line here, now the line doesn't fit very well. So you expect the line to have some curvature, and it turns out that the curvature, if you basically fit for the second derivative, it requires a universe whose expansion is speeding up instead of slowing down. So this is from the supernovae, which are kind of another. These are actually all from supernovae, which are kind of there's a standard candle that you probably most of you have heard. They're used to measure the distance, similar to basically what Hubble did back then. You think there are some stuff that have a standard luminosity. You measure their brightness based on that standard luminosity. You can infer that the distance. Okay, so that's it. And then they won the Nobel Prize. The people who just made this measurement. This is old news. Any questions? I think you all have. Yeah.
This is another astronomer thing. They're measuring luminosity in units of distance.
Yeah, that's right. So this is called distance measure, which is, and it's not really, it's really luminosity. So I wrote longer distance here, but this really has to do with magnitude. So that's right.
Do you have to put in the expanding universe at all? Because,
In what?
Because the distance depends on what.
Oh, good. So this is the distance which defined as basically respective. So this distance is defined, it's called so-called luminosity distance. So this luminosity divided by 4 pi d squared is observed flux. So this is how you define the distance. So it's not assuming any particular space-time. This is how you define it. So you say if something has some intrinsic luminosity and then you observe it, plug it in this ratio, and then you define the distance this way. So you can calculate it in FRW universe, and these curves assume Friedman, Robertson, Walker universe. But I mean, if you have weird cosmologies, they would be very different. Okay.
Basically, the distance in various disguises.
Yeah, with some redshift factors, right?
In
FRW cosmology, is co-moving distance for some redshift factor.
So you're just saying you define it like this, and then you translate that into, depending on the model that you're looking at, whether it's FRW or any other cosmology.
That's right. So the points come from this definition, that you think you understand supernovae from local observations, and you know how luminous it must be. And the flux is the flux you observe. You plug in that relationship, you observe a distance. So those are these points. And then the curves, depending on the model of cosmology. Okay. So, good. Now, so of course, that's the lambda, dark energy, or I guess dark energy is a slightly generalized version of lambda. This is the cosmological constant. This means that we will never be, if it's a constant, we will never be able to see beyond 60 billion light years. And larger scales, gravity becomes repulsive instead of attractive. So again, you all have known about this. So this is kind of the first appearance of Hubble trouble. In fact, Adam, if you're interested in this, Adam Riess gave a very comprehensive and entertaining colloquium about this. So Adam Riess is a cartoon of Adam Riess, who was, I guess you saw that his actual picture here, maybe slightly younger back then. He's kind of aiming for his second Nobel Prize. And I guess she's the woman here is Wendy Friedman, who I'm going to mention some of her work. She's also been very well known for measurements of Hubble constant. And you could watch the Adams colloquium here. It's all recorded. So the colloquium is very interesting because it goes over various measurements of Hubble constant through various different methods. And I'm going to summarize some of them here, but not all of them. His stuff mainly based on supernovae and cephades that I'm going to mention. But there are various ways of doing it. And he kind of has this tension matrix of you can have various picks of which data you are interested in and which one you don't trust. And no matter which one you pick, there is a tension unless you kind of start this discarding a lot of the data. Here, actually, unfortunately, you cannot read this very well. But the main lesson is that you have two sets of data. So you have many data sets, about a dozen set of various observations. I'm going to mention some of them, but not all of them. But some of them test early universe. So like microwave background, baryonic acoustic oscillations, and Big Bang nuclear synthesis. So we're going to talk about all of these at length later. Some of them measure the late universe, cephades, supernovae. We're going to talk about other stellar things, and we're going to talk about lensing. They all test the late universe. And what you can see clearly is that this Hubble in these funny units that we mentioned has this tension that early universe measurements are some number around 68, and they're all consistent with each other. And these are independent measurements, some from CMB, a microwave, some from Big Bang nuclear synthesis, some from baryonic acoustic oscillation. That doesn't sound like early universe, but they really probe of sound waves in the early universe. Measurement is done now, but it probes the sound speed, basically, in the early universe. So these are all low numbers. And there are about half a dozen low redshift measurements, late time measurements that are high numbers. And the tension is about 5 sigma now.
It's
now about 5 sigma. Could be even bigger, depending on, it keeps increasing, I don't know. It's it's about 5 sigma now. That's kind of the source of excitement, and a lot of cosmologists now, their discussions and colloquia and conferences is revolve around Hubble trouble. I don't know what it was supposed to be. Oh, yeah. Okay. It turns out that the Hubble trouble is not a new story. It's actually almost as old as the Hubble itself. So these are like, I gathered a bunch of measurements of Hubble as a function of time. In fact, Hubble measured Hubble constant to be of order 600, which is almost a factor of 10 bigger than what we measure now. It went down over time. Then around between 60s and 90s, there were two famous camps.
Whatever he measured had nothing to do with Hubble.
Well, we could we could say the same thing now, but I mean, they're always assumptions that turn out to be wrong, and I'm going to mention those assumptions, but yes, so that is generally true with any measurements. You always make some assumptions, and if your assumptions are wrong, independent of your error bars, of course, you'd be wrong. So these error bars are only random error bars. Systematic errors, if you knew them, they wouldn't be systematic errors. You would take them into account. The worst type of errors are the most, terrifying types of errors are systematic errors that you don't know about. And of course, if you don't know them, then it's not in your error budget. So I'm going to mention that in a minute. But in fact, that's the same. The same worries are still existent now for this measurement. So this was Hubble back then in the 20s. In 2000, it kind of settled between 50 and 100, or starting from 70s. Now, from 70s or 65 to 90, there were two very kind of persistent groups. There was one led by Devecouleur. I think it's this one, and another one by Alan Sandage, and his collaborators. And I think the Devecouleur always got 50s. You see, those are the star, which these are like empty stars. Actually, sorry, Devecouleur got 100. Sorry, and then Sandage got always 50. Hopefully, I'm not mixing those. But anyway, so this is the plot. And there are some in between as well, but they were always very persistent on their numbers. And there were a lot of contentions over time.
What do they measure different?
Right. So they have different criteria for what they think is the right measure of distance, right? And they all have very compelling arguments that they were right.
Are these mainly local measurements?
These are all measurements of Hubble constant. They're very local. So you see a galaxy, you try to decide what its distance is, right? And they all use different ways of measuring distance. So starting from the 90s, things started to converge. People realized that at this time they were underestimating the errors. So the errors were really much bigger than the differences. So you see these things are more or less consistent, and errors start to shrink over time. So this is 2008. And from 2000, you see that things start to converge around 70. So in 2012, that was kind of the last time everything agreed with each other, around 72 or so. And then that was in 2012, basically, when the Planck data came out, they started to diverge. So CMB started to prefer low values. Cepheids started to prefer high values. Now, this is a particular paper by Wendy Friedman. They used the tip of red giant branch, which is a particular type of stars, basically, if you look at the stars, to calibrate Cepheids, if I remember correctly. And
as I understand, all these local measurements, they are all from supernovae. And the difference is only how you calibrate.
Right.
So you use Cepheids in the same galaxy as some
supernovae. Right, I'm going to show.
To learn the distance to that galaxy. And then this red branch.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Same way, but it's all supernovae. It's just.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. So it's either Cepheid or. Yeah, you're right. You're absolutely right. It's all supernovae, but then you have to calibrate the supernovae somehow. That's right. Absolutely correct. Good. Other points? And I'm going to show actually another.
Then there's also CMB then.
Yeah, that's right. So CMB is completely independent, comes from.
So you're saying that the TRGB and the CMB.
Yeah, so these are basically, they both use, I think Levan is right, they both use supernovae, but they use different ways of calibrating supernovae because supernovae are rare events. They don't happen in our galaxies, they happen in far away galaxies. And you have to actually have already a way of measuring the distance to those galaxies. So these are different ways of calibrating supernovae. If you listen to Adam Riess's talk, he has a rebuttal for this. He says that they are not calibrating their TRGBs in an incorrect way. So, in fact, he had included the TRGBs here, but using a different calibration from the one that Wendy Friedman used. So Wendy Friedman's result is somewhere in between. But this is not, you shouldn't use that calibration. So it's all very, very much into the weeds and very technical.
Just a question in the left, bottom left corner slide.
This one.
The fact that things started to converge, was it that then the distance measure, was it systematics that became popular?
I think what happened is people at this some point here, they realized that the errors were much bigger than they thought. And I'm not sure exactly why they came to that realization. I suspect it has to do with, I guess, older people dying and younger people being over open-minded.
I'm just curious, like, what is it that caused that error to come down so much and converge?
These measurements,
Were they just systematics that were...
Yeah, I don't know.
Or was it that they converged on the distance?
I think they're just better measurements and more measurements, because I think these are mostly, they are stochastic, the errors were huge here, right, you see. So if you actually correctly estimate them, they were huge, which clearly they must have been.
Yeah.
So you need to have a galaxy which happens to contain both a Cepheid and a supernova.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just seeing a supernova is already...
It's
not rare, but it's... You know,
and the reason you could do it
both in the same galaxy is you need more and more data, basically, the Hubble telescope found.
One thing is one reason these errors were big back then is that you're not seeing very far if you don't have supernovae, because the stars you don't see them very far away, because all of these methods were based on most of them were based on individual stars. But if you don't see very far away, you're not in the Hubble flow. They're all random motions, like peculiar motions. And like Andromeda is not moving away from us, it's actually falling towards us. So supernova was the biggest step, but the problem is now how to calibrate the supernova. Because supernova you can see very far, but then you don't know exactly how bright they are. So that's...
What's TRG
mean? TRG is tip of the red giant branch, right? Remember correctly? So it's... the tail of the red.
Okay,
whatever you say, I'm happy. So is it just a red giant branch ends at some point, right? Because it starts when they die, they kind of continue and then stop and come back at some point. I'm trying to remember, is it because of a helium flash or something? So yeah, I meant to look this up, but yeah, it's something about a stellar evolution at the end in the red giant phase. And I mean, the idea is that you could predict it based on first principles. Is that the tip? Okay. Yeah. So, sorry. So, if you're not confused yet, I guess you have still 20 minutes to be confused. So, this is just compilation of, I'm not sure if actually, by a compilation of various measurements in omega matter and H naught. I guess it's interesting because I think historically cosmology has been called the science of two numbers, and it turns out, but now they have more numbers, but still, these are the two main important numbers that we keep talking about. And you see there are a lot of measurements, but it turns out that most of them are not very precise. The one thing that is very specific, very precise is Planck, which is this black region. The CMB itself, I'm going to show you, and most of you know, does very precise, because it has a lot of data in it. But like the one particular culprit we're talking about is this red guy, is supernovae, Cepheid calibrated supernovae, which is this red region, which is not, which is in conflict with Planck. There are a lot of other measurements, but they're mostly, I think there's lensing is here as well. But I just wanted to say that there are very confusing plots if you wanna look up an archive.
CVSN and what is?
So CVSN is the Cepheid-based local determination of H-naught.
SNPL?
SNPL, I think it's uncalibrated. It's just a bit just based on the shape. It's the original discovery of dark energy. So you don't have to calibrate. You just arbitrary normalization. So those are the two differences. So this is a kind of local supernovae. This is high redshift supernovae. And there are lots of other things. I'm going to show some of them in more detail. Now, this is the crux. I think if you want to take away one thing from this talk, and this is not obviously my style, these are the people who've written this, the Hubble Hunters guy. If you want to take one thing from this talk, is this this particular slide. And it says that there is inherent. It tells you where the discrepancies. Apparently, based on the way these authors argue, it's not that changing Hubble, you need to change expansion rate at late times, because we already measure expansion rate at late times, the geometry at late times, or we have a handle on it based on baryonic acoustic oscillations. So the only way that it seems you could make baryonic acoustic oscillation and supernovae consistent is by changing the sand horizon at the time of CMB. And I'm going to mention what these terms mean. But just think about it, that sound waves in the universe traveling, and you ask how far do they travel. This is how far they travel. And you could try to fit the CMB data. So that's this, Planck CMB data. So that you require some Hubble constant and some sound horizon. And then you can try to fit the supernova data, and baryonic oscillation data, if you wish. That's this one. You try to fit the shoes. I think this shoes is supernovae. Now I'm trying to remember. They must have something else for this RS. I don't actually remember where else they get. They have some other measure for RS.
The color
is little omega, which is omega matter times H squared. It has to do with matter density. So this is, I guess, high matter density. This is low matter density. I'm trying to remember that they say it's true. Maybe it's just the. No, I don't actually know what else. According to this. Oh no, sorry. I take them back. Yeah, this is this range, right? This is Planck at high res. So this is CMB at high L's. That means the small angles. This is CMB at large angles, right? L less than 800. So you already see that there is some tension in CMB here. That CMB, a small angle CMB and large angle CMB are barely consistent with each other. And if you combine them, you get these tiny error bars, but there is this tension already.
Is each circle one sigma?
These are 1 and 2 sigma, right? 1 and 2 sigma. But then if you look at Hubble that you get from supernovae, Adam Riess's Hubble, you get this high region, which is consistent with low resolution CMB. Like this is low resolution CMB, but not consistent with high resolution CMB. So this was that why WMAP didn't see this, because it had a low resolution, but Planck seems to see this, if it's real. Or maybe there's something wrong with Planck at high resolution.
So larger RS is better.
That's so right. So one way is if you want to resolve the tension is somehow you increase RS, right? And it's not easy how to do it because CMB is a very basically finely tuned machine. It's because you have lots of data. I guess I'm going to show you in a second the data for the CMB. You cannot just change one thing. Everything goes together. You have lots of peaks, so you fit all of them. So their suggestion is that the best way to do this is if you have some sort of early type dark energy around this redshift. So this is kind of they try to find the best model to explain the tension by changing this RS. And they say if you want to change RS and don't touch anything else, you have to some early dark energy around basically redshift of 1,000 or just a couple of thousand. So that's kind of their prescription, that if you want to do least damage, if you want to fit everything, you cannot just play with dark energy at late times, even though that may be the obvious thing to do. And a lot of people have tried it, including myself. You have to actually do something in the early universe.
So that changes T star, is that right? You just change T star?
It changes the expansion history. It changes HFZ.
Mm-hmm. So you keep the electron physics, the combination physics, but you change the time.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not just time, but the A of T would also be different, right? So, I think Z star would be probably the same, more or less, but then HFZ would be different. The main idea is that you have some sort of dark energy that's around just before recombination, but is not around after that because it's gonna screw up the distances after that. So that's apparently the way to do it. So that's
you need more positive dark energy at recombination.
I think it's positive, right? Just before recombination, like maybe more around matter radiation equality. That would be redshift 3,000 this year.
Does it have to turn off? Do you know about
that? Why should it turn off?
When?
Well, you see it here, right? It's around redshift 1,000, which is where recombination is happening as well. So it cannot last longer than that because there are strong constraints on it. And the fraction, it's around, I think this is roughly, this is roughly the fraction. You need around 2.5% or 2%. But I mean, it cannot persist longer than that. Otherwise it's gonna be ruled out. I mean, it's severely constrainless. So this is kind of the one thing you wanna take away from this is, there are a bunch of tensions, but at least the consensus seems to be leading to the direction that if this is a real effect, you want some sort of early dark energy.
So the shoes, this orange band is just seems inconsistent with.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, because of region.
Right. No. No. If you.
Does not. So the fact that we have these completely disparate. There's no overlap region of all.
No, I mean, I guess, did it say large RS or a small? I guess you want a small RS, right? Did it say, yeah. So because this here is the crossover, right? The shoes and BAO plus supernovae, the crossover is here. So CMB want to put you up here, but if you somehow could just change the CMB physics, you could like push everything down to here, right?
You think you could if you could mess around with that, then you could.
Yeah.
Constant lambda, mm-hmm. But you're saying that the CM messing around with CMB is very delicate. You can't really do.
Yeah,
that.
Right. I mean, it seems that the one model that could do it is at least people have worked it out. Is if you have early dark energy, which goes best. Which comes in quickly, it cannot be around for very long, and it should go very quickly as well. Right.
You know whether it would fix this mismatch between the large scale CMB and the small scale?
I actually don't know. I'm not sure if this model would fix this. I have to look it up.
But having dark energy, early dark energy, which is and you know, switching it off means the lambda is fluctuating, right? So
absolutely.
Fluctuating lambda.
Yeah, that's right.
So there's no resolution of this tension that you can't get a constant. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you have to sacrifice that.
Yeah. I mean that's one possibility. So, yeah. Okay. So I think maybe in the last 10 minutes, I'm just gonna go over a bunch of kind of what could be the resolutions. This is kind of the infamous Cepheid supernovae, I guess, conspiracy, if you want. So the idea is that Cepheids, actually, the reason that Hubble got it wrong was that he was looking at these classic Cepheids. These are the ones that you see close to us. But it turns out that there are brighter Cepheids. There aren't as many of them, but they are farther away. So there are these two branches. And it turned out the ones that he was saying for farther away galaxies were the brighter ones. The ones that you see in our galaxy are these classical ones. So that's basically what was the original mistake. Right? But of course, then if that was the case, maybe there are more types that are kind of more finely separated from each other. And who knows, maybe that's what's happening now. This is the modern diagram that Levan was referring to. So we measure Cepheids locally, like in LMC and in Milky Way, a large magellanic cloud in Milky Way. So we can measure the distances, say, from a variety of methods locally. I'm not sure. I guess some of these that come from masers. I think this is a maze there. There are parallax measurements within the Milky Way. I guess it's down here. So there are a bunch of measure methods that you can use very close by to measure the distance to Cepheid. So that's like the first rung of your ladder. Then there are about like a dozen or so galaxies that happen to have supernovae 1A. It's a particular type of supernovae that has been proven to be very good, very standard, and Cepheids at the same time. So these are kind of the main, the crux of the argument, that you require, basically, to go from here to cosmology, you require this calibration. So, and the reason it's important and it's kind of, in some sense, the weakest link is that there are only like a handful, or I guess two handful. How many handful? Four handful of these, roughly. There are about, like, I think, 19 of these, right? These guys, you can count them. And if they are somehow systematically different from the rest of supernovae 1As, then that could screw up the argument. And then from here, after you calibrate this, then you could measure your Hubble, draw your Hubble diagram, basically. But you have to calibrate the supernovae somewhere, and these 20 Cepheid supernovae galaxies, those are the key to this calibration. So that could be the weakest link.
So in that graph, then you're assuming that, so suppose you could get many more bits of data, and you didn't have this weakest link was strengthened by getting much more data.
Yeah.
The extrapolation to the larger shift, is that something that is very model dependent?
No, it's not. It's because if you assume you have a kind of FRW cosmology or anything near FRW cosmology, I mean, people do talk about like local voids, but that require like, I don't know, 5 sigma, 10 sigma deviations from a standard Gaussian statistics. So no, this is just basically Hubble law, which is linear plus some small curvature, right? So that extrapolation, I think it's pretty robust if you're in the frame between GR and basically FRW, homogeneous FRW framework. The part that's, I guess, the most suspect is basically if this Cepheid, so this these Cepheids and supernovae are the same as these Cepheids and the same as these supernovae, right? So because they could be somehow systematically different, right? So that's right. So there are some Cepheids we see here, right? We can measure the distance to. There are some Cepheids and that happen to live in the same galaxy that supernovae 1A live in. And there are some supernovae 1A that just live random places far away. If there have some systematic, even a small systematic offsets, that could be a problem, right? So that's kind of the weakest link here. But then the interesting thing, this argument is that there is a completely different line of argument, and some of you know probably Sherry Suyu, who was here, will she be here next week? Probably not, no. But she's also an Emmy Noether Fellow, or was an Emmy Noether Fellow here. And she is part of this Holy Cow project. And they measure the Hubble constant based on a strong lensing. Basically, they have a collaboration where they monitor quasar light curves that are seen or have multiple images. And by measuring the time delay between these light curves, basically time delay is something in units of years or seconds. So basically, inverse of that would be proportional to the Hubble constant. The weakest link there is that you have to model the trajectory that light goes through to reach us from basically these different directions. But if you think you can model that properly, and they've put a lot of effort into trying to model that properly and be do like a double blind analysis of this, then you can measure match these time delay. Sorry, you can match these time delays between these different light curves to a Hubble constant. And it turns out that lo and behold, the measurement of Hubble constant they have, and in fact they have even a smaller error bar now, is consistent with the one that you get from supernovae. So this is the kind of completely independent.
So it's a time variation of, let's say, brightness.
Yes, that's right. Exactly.
And how far in redshift is this object?
Let me see. Do I have? I mean, these are around redshift one. I think the quasar around redshift ref 1.5 or so. I don't remember. Yes, well, I mean, very high by, I mean, it's not CMB redshift, that's right. But it's not local like supernova, the redshift one. So indeed, there could be degenerations with other cosmological parameters, but they try to marginalize over all other parameters, and they claim that basically Hubble is really the most important, but there is very little degeneracy with other things, right?
Lensing is due to something they know?
They're like a cluster. Yeah, usually there is a cluster. Yeah, I mean, what they see basically, they see four images that have exact same spectrum, and the light curves look the same, except there's a time shift.
Right, but they need to know something about the mass of the cluster.
Well, no, that's the thing, that you could actually model this out, because the mass would give you the deflection angle, right? So that's the way you can find that. You have basically multiple observables. You have the deflection angles, and then there is the time delay. So if you have the deflection angles, then you get and you have a bunch of you make a bunch of other assumptions. You get enough about enough information about the mass. You can, of course, if you see a stuff here, you can measure the redshift, right? So that you have a bunch of things. You know where the cluster is, you know the distribution of galaxies within the cluster, so they all go into the lens model. I mean, if Neil Dalal was here, I mean, he's done this, and he's generally very skeptical of any kind of lensing thing. And historically, there have been things that were very wrong with lensing interpretation. But I don't know, things, you could say the same thing with supernova. Things are seem to be much more solid now, but could there still be a small effect, who knows? So, any questions? Yes?
You can mention gravitational waves as well.
No, I'm not. But I mean, of course, that's going to be very important in the future. And right now, the gravitational waves are measurements, but the error is like a factor of 10 too big. Maybe in 10 years, that's going to be competitive. Okay. Now, I think I don't really, I mean, since I have a very sharp cutoff for myself, for those of you who some of these buzzwords are kind of a bit cryptic, when we talk about CMB and BAO, CMB is cosmic microwave background, BAO, baryonic acoustic oscillations, but what they are really are sound waves in the early universe. So basically, imagine Big Bang goes boom, and then the sound waves just go at the speed of sound, which is like 1/3 times the speed of light. So these sound waves would have some basically imprints in the microwave background, and then would have some imprint on galaxy distribution. And basically, they're your standard ruler that if you could measure this scale in various places, you know how far they are. And we do it for CMB with high precision. So there is this is data from CMB, which is now a few years old. But it seems that basically you fit it very well, and there's one sound wave or sound distance, sound horizon that comes out of this. And you could do it with baryonic acoustic oscillation, which is this scale. And they are consistent with each other, and they give you basically the constant, the geometry of the universe. So this here, everything fits together. So basically, the main consistency between these guys, which are purely local measurements, this is not purely local, but it still just uses late universe physics. And then there are these guys that use sound waves, cosmic sound waves, basically, in the recombination era. And that's and there is also Big Bang nucleosynthesis that also is consistent with this. So that's kind of what you got. This is the early universe physics from recombination or earlier prefers von Hubble, and late universe from lensing and cepheids and supernova prefers another Hubble. So that's the status. So it seems that you cannot just fix it with one, just dismissing one data set. You need to dismiss at least two data sets or more to be able to fix this. And it turns out there are other tensions. One is, this just came out like in last week, made a lot of big news, that somehow omega, the curvature of the universe is preferred to be something other than zero from Planck. And again, you could put Hubble and omega k in the same plot. So Planck is here, and BAO plus BBN plus supernovae are here. So that seems to be kind of bizarre. Sigma 8 is another tension. So it would be nice if you could have a scenario that solves all these tensions. Do you know what's an agenda for tomorrow morning? Does anybody, you have the schedule. Thanks. It's Yasaman at 11. Okay. The CPO is later. So I was gonna say a little bit about the solutions, but maybe I will try to leave this for the yes, go ahead.
I have a general question that might actually sort of lead into your models. Just firstly, a question on terminology.
Yeah.
If an alternative model doesn't fit the data to 2 sigma, it's said to be ruled out. Yeah, here we have a 5 sigma.
Yeah.
And it's called a tension.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have explained briefly one or two of the things that may be.
But you see, the name is kind of evolving. So it was tension, I think, when it was 3 sigma. And I think now some people, as I said, trouble, crisis, the name does evolve over time. So.
But nobody's saying that the model's been ruled out.
I think the model, and I think this has to do, and we're going to discuss this probably more later, has to do with like your Bayesian framework of mind, that you only rule out a model if there's a better model. If there is no better model, you say, okay, so there are tension, you've seen this in historically, like they just observers underestimate the errors all the time.
But my question was going to be this, you have made one or two comments about how the observations, the actual measurements of H0 may run into problems. What are the main possible problems with the CMB models, the actual data?
That's
not so much data analysis, but the actual models.
That's an excellent question. The problem is there isn't one.
That you know of?
Yeah, well, or that anybody. I mean, people do discuss it. Sorry?
Oh no, there's loads of things you can question.
Well, yeah, but I mean, if you look at any of them carefully, it's not clear any of them could. I mean, if within the context of a standard G GR plus lambda CDM. Now, if you go beyond GR, of course, that, then there would be new physics, and we have a host of things that could go wrong. But the problem is that CMB is linear physics, and we understand this. We've had codes that run this for 30 years. We've even done second order calculations, and various people. There have been claims that people have missed things in the CMB, and then there have been like redundancies, and all that those claims have been withdrawn. So
you could assume like dark energy decaying.
Yeah, those are all new physics, right?
Yeah, but that's what.
No, but aren't you asking about this?
I think even more fundamentally. Mm-hmm. To what extent do calculations of CMB depend on the curvature being small, for example? Has anyone ever done large curvature?
Yeah, absolutely.
So my question was a little bit more general.
Mm.
In the sense that most people tend to think about the observations having systematics, if you look at it from the other point of view, what are the things you might actually question about the standard model? And I'm leading into your papers because you're going to give some.
Yeah, right, absolutely. And I think thanks a lot for doing that. But I have to, because of the personal reason, I have to break now. You can of course go on without me. But yeah, I think maybe we can discuss more the physics tomorrow. So I'm going to maybe the same thing that Sumati did. Did
the
ask?
Into the next.
Yeah.
You can go into Yasemin's, or you can go into my talk.
Yeah.
Because that's.
Maybe we'll discuss that tomorrow, which is the best way.
Yeah,
we're gonna plan that tomorrow. But yeah, I'm not gonna talk more about the explanations of this. I think that the thing I'd like to take away from this is that there are tensions that are some of them are very serious. You can see some of them.
I'll make a case not in a sample form.
Well, it's a three sigma thing. Yeah.
Why do you say it's not in the same ballpark?
Because it's only three sigma.
Yeah, it's not five sigma yet. Yeah.
And lots of models get ruled out at two sigma.
No, but nobody rules out.
But if omega k is substantial, I don't actually know what that result is. Is it like a couple of percent or?
Mm. Yeah, this is the number. You see, it's minus point. It's minus 0.04 or so, but it's three sigma away from zero.
So it's
not the best way to see it.
It's a few percent, right? It's a few percent.
Yeah.
And when modeling CMB?
No, the problem is that the BAO, it's not consistent. So you have to kind of get rid of BAO, basically. So.
Is that positive curvature?
It's a closed universe. So I don't know if you followed the headlines. It's everywhere that universe is closed, and of course. If you ignore this data set, then universe is closed.
So if it's derived from Planck data, why Planck doesn't lead that noise, right?
Planck
noise doesn't come from Planck.
Positive curvature.
Yeah.
It's from these people.
Yeah, that's right. No, the Planck had the exact same thing, yeah. So
Planck didn't trumpet this.
Yeah, Planck didn't trumpet this, even though it is in their paper. So, I mean, it's really a statement of inconsistency. I guess all I want to say is that it's not just Hubble. These two other parameters also have tension at a lesser degree. So it's these are around three sigma tensions, basically.
What's the second tension about?
This one?
Yeah,
so this is, it's hard to see it here, but it's sigma 8 is the amplitude of fluctuations. And you measure it from lensing in local galaxies. And you could measure it from CMB, of course. And here, this tension doesn't seem to be very big, but it turns out that if it's consistent, it's actually more serious than this, because if all the other lensing surveys give you something that's closer to here than here. So that's around three sigma tension, the local, basically what you're thinking about is amplitude of fluctuations in matter. If you measure it here and you measure it from the CMB, they don't quite agree with each other. That's sigma 8 tension. Omega k is tension is just the curvature of the universe, right? And yeah, it's just, it turns out that they don't agree. You can see that this data doesn't agree with this data, and this data doesn't agree with this data. So these tensions are there. So ideally, if you have a model that could explain all these tensions, or maybe just some of these tensions are statistical flukes and will go away. Okay, so on that note, I have to, I'm sorry, I'm chairing myself, but I have very strong constraints. So let's end for today, and I see everybody tomorrow at 11, if not earlier. Thank you.